Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
It has been difficult, if not downright impossible, to pick up a newspaper over the past decade and not find a story about some company going bankrupt because of the poor business decisions or illegal activities undertaken by the firm's executives. Corporations such as Enron, WorldCom, and Tyco, and individuals such as Bernie Madoff have become synonymous with executive mismanagement and illicit and immoral behavior. And the overly risky investment decisions behind the 2008 financial meltdown sullied the reputations of J.P. Morgan, AIG, Bear Stearns, and put companies like Lehman Brothers and Washington Mutual out of business. All of this has given capitalism and free enterprise a black eye. The image of the fictional investor Gordon Gekko in the movie Wall Street declaring that greed, for lack of a better term, is good, has come to haunt the American enterprise system as of late. Of course, greed is not good. We shudder at such a statement. But what about free enterprise and the pursuit of profit by making products that improve the lives of others? Can entrepreneurial activity in an open market be pursued in an ethical manner? Does a virtuous approach to business pay dividends for those who practice it? And what might this have to do with religion and Judeo-Christian religious values? We ask those questions to our guest today, Dr. Theodore Malek, a research professor at Yale University who heads up the Spiritual Capital Initiative at Yale's Center for Faith and Culture. If that wasn't enough to do, Dr. Malek is chairman and CEO of the Global Fiduciary Governance Limited Liability Corporation. He has started a wide array of other businesses and consulting firms and served on the executive board of the World Economic Forum, which hosts the annual Davos Conference. He has also authored a number of books, including America's Spiritual Capital and Doing Virtuous Business, The Remarkable Success of Spiritual Enterprise, both of which will be the focus of our conversation today. The latter book, I should add, was also the subject of a PBS documentary program. He also has a book coming out in March called The End of Ethics, about the worst business practices that he's witnessed over the past several decades and how they can be fixed. Dr. Malek's other list of accomplishments is very extensive, so we'll just point you in the direction of our website, where you can find a full biographic profile of him and other links to the activities he has engaged in. Ted, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Hey, this Davos, Switzerland thing, I mean, wow, that is a really big deal because that gets into the news every year. And
end of January every year at the Alpine Ski Resort, you know, the world's who's who, all gathering, converting together. I know you wanted to be there.
I do, because I never make that list. I run to my mailbox every...
Did you send them the check for $60,000? Oh. Maybe that's why you didn't get invited.
$60,000. Well, you know, actually, that's cheaper than University of Washington football tickets, so I should maybe do that. Actually, I got a question about that. Who gets invited to this thing, and what do you guys do when you're there?
Yeah. So I was on the executive board for 5 years, the only American in the late 80s, mid-90s. Haven't been involved recently, but it's more or less the same. I might give you a reference, since I'm an academic. I wrote an article for the Weekly Standard last year on this topic, exactly last January. The meeting takes place the end of January every year in this small town in Switzerland, Davos, up in the mountains. And the title of that article was Drinking the Davos Kool-Aid.
Mm.
So who gets invited? The ministers of government of every government in the world, some you've never heard of, CEOs of every sort and stripe from every industry, and they actually have an opportunity to meet and, you know, to hear some very smart people and mostly themselves talk. The operative word at Davos, at least recently, has been any word with re attached to it.
Mm.
So readjust, rebrand, redesign, you know, fill in the blank.
So we're basically redoing the whole world again.
You got it. Okay. So there are three theories about Davos, not that we want to talk about it alone. The first is that it's a Swiss cabal, that the Swiss pay for it. They're this independent, strong nation in the middle of Europe, very neutral, and they have all these conspiracies that take place in Switzerland. That's at least half true.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm not invited back.
Yeah.
Second, that it is a place where there's a lot of collusion, maybe even for your conspiracy theorists, a lot of conspiracy going on, particularly among these capitalists who are cavorting with each other and making big deals. That is more or less true. Some of that is legal. Some of it may be questionable. But if you want to see, the minister of Ouagadougou or do a deal in some out-of-the-way place, Davos is likely the place where you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of big things have been announced there, like the reunification of Germany or Turkey maybe joining the EU, some significant things.
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, I guess you are onto this, that some people, particularly in the right, see it as the forerunner of global government,
mm-hmm.
that there is this kind of Davosian spirit. I call it New Age Davosianism, and that people go to that altitude and they either get altitude sickness or they start to suffer from the same disease.
Mm.
But in reality, what I tell all CEOs, and it's mostly CEOs who pay to go, I say, go. It's a blast. The food is really good. They've got late-night dancing, unbelievable ski slopes, and you get to meet hundreds of people from all around the world. And, it's probably worth that investment.
Well, I might have to try that sometime when I become an important CEO of something. So I imagine you get pretty good food there, and you actually eat on real China porcelain plates.
Oh, yeah. They have Angelique, Jolie in a hot tub, and, unbelievable rock bands playing, the best of the best. The real list, if you want a little salacious humor here, is the guest list at Davos.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, who's there with the CEO of X or the president of Peru? That is a highly guarded secret.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine. I'm glad you mentioned Angelique Jolie, because now we can put her as a tag on our podcast. I never thought that would actually happen here. So, but it's pretty cool, because usually the conferences I go to are usually paper plates or brown bags. So maybe someday I'll make it to the porcelain China. But hey, let's get down to business of the business of spiritual capital. And more specifically, you're talking about America's spiritual capital, which is the title of the book you co-authored with Nicholas Capaldi. Now, I want to get into this because it does bring up the whole issue of religion, which is the focus of our podcast. But let's start off with a little bit of economics here. Now, the term capital is one that's used in economics and business a great deal. Basically, for the non-economists in our audience, capital is just the stuff that helps you to make other stuff. We can think of physical capital as being like a hammer or assembly line machines or entire factory buildings. And then we also frequently talk about financial capital, which is basically money or other financial assets that allow people to invest in making other stuff. Now, economists, people like Gary Becker and a few other folks, have often talked about human capital, which is the intellectual know-how and our set of learned skills that have helped us make things better and more efficiently. Education in our modern society is all about developing human capital. But then in your book, you use two other terms that I think need a little bit of definition here: social capital and spiritual capital. So let's start with social capital. What is social capital?
Well, let me first say that the nice thing about having Nick Capaldi as my co-author, he's the foremost Catholic philosopher in America at Loyola University. So anything you don't like about our arguments or this book, you can blame him.
Got it.
And anything you do like, you can praise me. And that is the real benefit, which I suggest to people, of having a co-author.
Absolutely.
But to start with your questions, social capital, is a concept that's been around a couple of decades. Sociologists have continued to focus on this idea. World Bank, other places, James Coleman produced a book on this, and you mentioned Gary Becker already, who wrote a book, Accounting for Taste, in 1996, I believe. Social capital became the center of attention with, of course, Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, in the year 2000. So that was the importance of social capital for corporate action as well has been taken up by people like Cohan and Prusak. And social capital is basically, that linkage between people in the social spheres that allows them to network and do business. So it's actually critical to any economy, to any social enterprise. Spiritual capital is something that I'm forever associated with, and I was kind of the father of some of this thinking. Spiritual capital, I would say, refers to our most fundamental beliefs concerning who we are, the meaning of our lives, the special regard to how these beliefs relate to our professional careers, to the economy, to what we do. So a large part of our lives is you know, your students too, is focused on some relatively small and specific task. And once in a while, probably in your class or those like it, someone tries to put the big picture together. You know, what does it all mean? And not every individual, but every organization, every culture has to answer those big questions. You know, who are we? Sam Huntington's question about America. What is the world all about? Meta-theoretical questions. How to relate to the world, both human and physical sense. And the answer to those questions, I say, constitutes our spiritual capital then. So if you want a definition, my definition is spiritual capital is the fund of beliefs, examples, and commitments that are transmitted from generation to generation. They're handed down. That's why they have this longevity, legacy, typically through a religious or a spiritual tradition. And we might debate amongst ourselves how strong are those religious commitments anymore in America or anywhere else in the world. That's an interesting topic. But they attach then people to what I call the transcendental source of human happiness. So spiritual capital is an absolutely critical thing, and we need to study it more and understand it and see how it affects our institutions and our lives.
Now, you mentioned beliefs and traditions a lot, as well as commitments. Does it have any more tangible aspect to it? Many people would say, and Putnam himself would say, social capital is realized through various civic organizations. Bowling leagues is the one he famously became associated with. But what about spiritual capital? Is it religious practice and people gathering together on Saturdays or Sundays to meet with one another? Is that an important aspect of this?
Oh, no, absolutely. It's all that. And these traditions in America is absolutely critical. When you look at it over the long term, historically, these religious commitments, I'm not talking about one, the interesting history is to look at a whole variety of them, have given rise to not only our family lives, but our church lives, our parachurch lives, the forming of institutions like colleges and universities. I teach at Yale, which was a Congregationalist college seminary in the first instance, and to hospitals and to voluntary associations, to scouting movements, you name it. We have formed it, and most of that in America and in many places around the world has risen out of this category that, for better or worse, I would call spiritual capital. It gives rise to all those kinds of things, including business enterprises, which most people don't think of that in the first instance, but that's what a lot of my research has been about.
Exactly, and that's where we want to go and head with this, because that is the surprising aspect. A lot of my students, when I talk about religion and its role in our daily lives, they think of the four square church on the corner, and that's where religion happens. But you make a very good case that this can spill into the business world and other aspects of our life, and probably should as well. Now, one of the things that you talk about is America's spiritual capital, and you link that with the Judeo-Christian spiritual capital ethos. And that makes a lot of sense, because even though America has been a place where many faith traditions have settled and have been welcomed, the predominant culture has really been based on a Judeo-Christian foundation. In your book, on spiritual capital, I should say, you go through a number of elements of this Judeo-Christian culture that you consider to be crucial to America's spiritual capital. Go through some of those. Let's start with progress.
Yeah, no, we make this big argument. Well, the first argument, I guess, is students always want to know, well, what are the examples of spiritual capital? So the two that I give just to get their attention are the end of the slave trade, nothing insignificant, you know, the largest institution of economic important, certainly in the 16th, 17th centuries, 1807, we put an end to it. That came largely as a result of the abolitionist movement, particularly in William Wilberforce and Clapham sect in England and then in the U.S. So that's a huge example of spiritual capital work. And then I have lots of examples of companies, so I collect company examples. We could talk about some of those later. They're very fascinating because they come out of different traditions. And some of these companies have have real durability. In other words, they've existed for 150, 200 years. They really last. The DNA is there, so they're quite interesting to look at. And some of them are large. You know, they're over $1 billion, so they're not insignificant. But we make this argument about America as the exemplar of the Judeo-Christian heritage of spiritual capital. And the two theses that we present are, first, you know, the logic of modernity, and that means that modernity is really what we call a technological project.
Mm-hmm.
That means that the transformation of nature for human betterment has taken over. That's what we live in today, this technological project, as opposed to what we find in some places still in the most backward parts of the world, a kind of fatalistic conformity. So this technological project requires inner-directed people. It requires free market economies that maximize competition and particularly innovation. I mean, that's what Adam Smith was writing about in the Pin Factory, right? These free market economies operate best within a limited government, what Montesquieu called a commercial republic, or Madison in Federalist 10, you know, outlined. This limited government can only be maintained under a rule of law. That's what makes places like Hong Kong or Singapore, you know, so different from other places in Asia, right? Read Hayek, read Oakeshott about the rule of law. Now, that rule of law can only be sustained, we argue, if there's a larger cultural context that celebrates individual autonomy, and that autonomy presupposes a larger, here's your favorite word, ontological claim about human freedom or free will that requires a spiritual or a theological commitment. And that personal autonomy avoids self-destruction. It also adds a spiritual content to the technological project when the responsible use of freedom leads to helping to fulfill God's plan by eliminating suffering and promoting freedom for others. So this whole thing really is really tied together. You go from the technological project through the free market economy to limited government, to the rule of law, to the culture of personal autonomy, to the personal God of the Judeo-Christian heritage, back to the technological project. It's all interlinked.
Mm-hmm. And one of the nice things that you do about this is that many of the elements that you just talked about here, from progress to requiring innovation, free market economy, and limited government, economists and political economists do a lot of that already. What you end with, and you consider it to be a very critical aspect of all of this, is that aspect of spiritual capital. That, you know, it is very possible. Some could see a world wherein, you know, enhanced individualism or personal autonomy could lead to anarchy and chaos and all sorts of trouble, but that spiritual capital is the glue that actually is very critical in helping to hold all this stuff together.
Yeah, no, we say that, you know, basically, in order to discover one's greatest sense of fulfillment or purpose, which comes from your freely imposing order on yourself in the first instance, in order to impose that kind of creator on the world and in the economy, I mean, that's the closest way we come to knowing God. So if that's the case, then that leads us to maintain that this personal autonomy and this free market requires a theological support.
Okay. Let me ask you a little bit about that. What does personal autonomy and individual freedom mean, and why is that so such an important link? And then also, how does the Judeo-Christian tradition help to support and maintain that?
Well, I mean, the understanding of freedom is absolutely critical to our argument, to any argument that has to do with Judeo-Christian values and with a free economy.
Mm-hmm.
We argue that these theological and philosophical arguments have come down to us through the medieval world, through the Renaissance. Certainly, there are some notions of them even already in the ancient in Aristotle. But it's not until the modern world that we see this notion of a free and independent person emerging.
Yeah, you do that. You do that very well in your book, and the contrast.
Yeah, it's a long philosophical, historical argument, and,
right?
And it's important to know because in some universities, what could I say, you don't find these arguments any longer. You find something quite different. So we try to trace those roots and also highlight them in the American founding, which is critical, and to look at Madison in particular and Federalist Number 10, which I talked about, Tocqueville, a great French commentator on the American Democratic Republican experiment in its early years. So we make those arguments pretty boldly in this little book.
Yeah, let me play on that a little bit, because there's a part of the book that I really enjoyed where you contrasted the transition from feudalism to modernity or a modern economy. And you have on pages 74 to 75 of the book, which again, we'll link to on our website, you have this list of things that were different in the past and things that are transformative in our modern world that really gave rise to political and economic freedom, which gives rise to innovation and such. Go through a little bit of that and tell us how Judeo-Christianity has really played a major role in that.
Yeah, here we're looking at the work of some other scholars, Jane Jacobs and Deidre McCluskey, to be specific, and we build on those arguments, and we try to contrast the virtues of what we call the feudal agrarian society, and some of these societies still exist in the world today. I would even argue in America there's still some of these feudal kind of elements at work, but certainly in third world and developing countries. And then we contrast that with the virtues of what we call the modern commercial society, which is the technological project. So you move from feudalism, where they shun trading, to our present globalized economy, where we certainly applaud trading and we shun force. We move from a situation where, in medieval settings, they exerted prowess, to today we have all these voluntary agreements and voluntary commitments, mediating structures in society. We move from a society where obedience, discipline, almost servitude is required, to one where you have honesty. I mean, honesty, and we come back to this about the ethics that are not be present or are lacking today, but honesty is absolutely imperative for a global market economy. Move from high use of tradition to the acceptance of initiatives and enterprises, from respect for hierarchies to respect for contracts today, from the high degree of loyalty to, a high degree of efficiency today, the vengeance that was present in the past world to, now an inventiveness to the use of invention and cooperation. Risk-taking today is certainly accepted. In the past, it was shunned. The acceptance of leisure, or too much leisure in the past, and today the promotion of comfort, convenience. In the past, this notion of, particularly amongst the feudal lords, of ostentatious behavior, today to a notion, at least in many circles, of investment for productive purposes. And then, I mean, this whole discussion of thrift, I wrote a whole book on the virtue of thrift. That's, again, another very, very interesting comparison. So I think the overriding one that I would point to is the difference between fatalism, the fatalistic opportunities in the past, which were viewed as just handed down from on high, you couldn't get past on the Mayan calendar, to today, where the individual is optimistic and takes reality into his or her own hands.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back, because when you were going through this list, something struck me a little bit. You mentioned that the feudal values of leisure and, for the elite, ostentatious consumption have been replaced by more modern commercial values of what you say, comfort, and also then instead of ostentatious consumption, of making things more productive or efficient.
And convenient.
Convenient. Make that tension, because when I think some of my listeners would be listening and say, well, what's the difference between leisure in the feudal world and comfort in today's modern society?
Well, it's a good question and a good contrast, and you could paint some interesting pictures and even read novels about this whole subject like Gatsby, but generally, if you look at someone with the wealth and magnitude of a Gates or a Buffett today, they're inventing new things. They're going on to new enterprises. They're reinventing. I'm not saying they don't live very luxurious lives, very wealthy lives. Obviously, they do. But in the past, the feudal lords in prior settings didn't even contribute to the economy. They just lived off their land and the labor of others. Mm-hmm. They didn't contribute anything.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very, very different modalities. I think we need to praise more today this role of the entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, even serial entrepreneurship, people who start multiple companies. I know people that have started a dozen companies. One guy who started 75 companies. Just think what they've added to the betterment of mankind, as opposed to some lord sitting in some medieval castle who basically just collected taxes.
So those are the values that contrast differently between the feudal era and our now modern commercial era. And one of the things that you talk about is the Judeo-Christian ethos, or the ethical structure that was given rise by these two great Abrahamic religions. How has Judeo-Christianity and Judaism and Christianity helped to move us from that feudal structure and to a more modern commercial structure? What is there within Christianity, let's say, that helps us celebrate more of these commercial virtues?
Well, there's a long list of things. Among others, I would say this notion of human dignity and of the person, the imago Dei, that all people are made in the image of God. Well, that then basically puts into question past kinds of relationships and opens up the possibility of cooperating with others as equals. So that's a modern notion, but it has come to fruition in the last couple hundred years.
And you can see how that plays out. Yeah, you can see how that plays out in transforming feudalism, because feudalism, as you mentioned, one of the characteristics of feudalism was obedience. You weren't equal. You're born into your serf spot, and that's it.
So.
Yeah, and a very fatalistic outlook. And once you start putting people on equal planes and say, God gave you a bunch of gifts, and you can go out and use those, whether you're a serf or a king, lo and behold, you start working with other individuals. Yeah.
Another thing that I would point to, particularly in the Protestant Reformation, which I guess I am religiously tied to, having grown up a Presbyterian, is that the Protestant work ethic promoted the notion of inner-directed individual, the emphasis on work or achievement, quality before the law, differentiation based on achievement. And Protestants, particularly dissenting Protestants, were willing then to concede an arrangement in which the political realm was not subordinate to the religious realm, as long as the political realm was obliged to respect the traditional spiritual realm, Christianity. And then you see the beginning of this tension between liberty and equality, and this whole notion then within Protestantism of the spiritual realm and how it was to be understood as an opportunity to do God's work in the world, economically even, by transforming the world and all of its attendant circumstances. I can't overemphasize enough how important this notion in the 16th century was and how formative it has been for capitalism itself.
You just mentioned something that is rather intriguing. That's the issue of the tension between liberty and equality. Now, when we talk about the scriptures, many people don't think necessarily about the aspects that we just talked about, putting people on equal terms, which really opens the door to individualism and to work, the work ethic, and to using your God's given gifts to make the world better, the technological project, as you're saying. Most people don't make that connection. A lot of people say, well, when it comes to talking about economics, the Bible, you got to turn to the Sermon on the Mount here. And this is where Jesus really starts talking about the poor, and many people go into the issue of redistributive policies of government. What is this tension between liberty and social justice, as people call it today?
Yeah, or equality, as they used to call it, and it's a very real tension. And this goes back and begs all these questions about biblical definitions of poverty and what is meant. Is poverty of a physical sense? Is it a spiritual sense? What does it have to do with? And how do we transform some Old Testament or even New Testament concepts of poverty into the present world. So this is all very interesting turf. So we make this argument about a properly functioning market economy and the notion of competition. Now, in any competitive situation, you're a big football fan, I know, Tony, there are winners and losers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not denying this. So it's not the market then that fails, but of necessity, individuals and individual businesses within the market fail. So the consumer, in a sense, remains sovereign, and the people who own the work fail, they can fail. And their occupations, obviously, some of them expanded some economies and some of them closed down and others. There's always competition. So the winners are not necessarily tomorrow's winners. You know, things change. There's a lot of dynamism, particularly in today's economy. That tomorrow's losers are not necessarily tomorrow's losers. Now, the only person who wins, we argue, is the sovereign consumer in an expanding economy. Not everyone seems to be emotionally, psychologically capable of living in such a world. So what we have in the present world, and it certainly abounds, there's no denying it, is this kind of dysfunction, even in free societies, and we might call that dysfunction poverty. I mean, it exists. It's not going to go away, and we have to deal with it. There are numerous ways to deal with it. Obviously, one way is charity. We can come back to that. Another way is the structure of the economy, which is important. Another way is governmental policies. There are all kinds of political correct explanations for, you know, poverty today, but the default remedy is usually, as you say, some form of redistributionism. Mm-hmm. So we take on that whole notion and ask about the social problems that come up as a result of people having this personal sense of autonomy and the presence of poverty, both domestically and internationally. And I'm an international economist, so I think the greatest obstacle to globalization is the resistance to cultural change that leads to substitute the notion of personal autonomy for more collectivist conceptions of the self. I mean, this is why some countries fail while some economies stagnate. So those who argue that this, and you hear this often on the left, amounts to a kind of Western cultural hegemony or imperialism, I think are dead wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What we really are looking at in reality is autonomy is a fundamental truth about human nature. And its prevalence in the West, as I just argued with you, is the result of the Judeo-Christian inheritance. A lot of non-Westerners who have experienced and embraced personal autonomy are beginning to recognize that it does really add to a kind of transformation both of the self and of their societies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way to overcome poverty.
Yeah, that is, it's a really good point. And I think one of the things that comes out in your reading or your writing extremely well is that issue of personal autonomy. And that's oftentimes overlooked when people debate the scriptures and its relationship to economics. And I think it's one that most people would do well to revisit here.
And revisiting it means, it goes back to this giving a man a fish or teaching him how to fish kind of parable. And we would argue that wealth creation, and people don't make this argument any longer. We have to remake this argument. Wealth creation is absolutely critical because it inculcates the requisite income-generating skills. It shows a person the way to the river, in effect. It makes available the necessary tools required for doing what we're talking about, for ensuring that there's a demand for his excess, for providing the ancillary services that are required by the person to ensure that he can maximize his potential. So this is a different focus. It's a focus on what we call empowerment. And poverty is only overcome, we would argue, when people are empowered, when they're allowed to help themselves without the undue influence of others, and particularly from the government or its agencies. And that has been part of American history, I would argue, until the recent past.
Yeah, you can understand how the collectivist mentality really can impinge upon personal autonomy and basically start to chip away at the entrepreneurs or the wealth creators, and eventually there isn't enough wealth to redistribute if you don't have
those. Yeah, we could all move to France where they have a 75% tax rate, or if you prefer Sweden, 82%. Eventually it becomes 100%. Will there be any wealth creation?
That is the next question I want to turn to, and I want to focus on the issue of how wealth can be created within a Judeo-Christian ethical framework. And you do this great in your book, Doing Virtuous Business. And what is nice about this, and we've been talking more or less at a metaphysical level here, but in that book, Doing Virtuous Business, you really ground these metaphysical concepts into very specific virtues that manifest themselves in a variety of different companies in a variety of different ways here. So let's go ahead and do that. Let's take these abstract virtues and ground them specifically. And in the book, you divide what is interesting to me. You divide some necessary virtues into two different categories here.
We're doing virtue ethics, which is a little uncommon, because people gave that up about 200 years ago and haven't been doing it, at least in universities or in business schools where I teach. So I have master's degree students in Ivy League school that ask me the question, what is virtue? They have no idea.
Well, actually, what is virtue? That's a good question.
Well, virtue is the alignment of the mind, body, and spirit with what is right. So it's good behavior. It's right behavior. It's good character formation, and then the institutionalization of those character traits in the companies or in the entities that we build. Of course, I'm here looking at companies largely. We could talk about not-for-profits. I don't do that largely, but public, private, large, medium, small, partnerships, proprietorships, every industry, every continent, every one of these evidencing some kind of DNA, some kind of spiritual capital in the way that they conduct their business, from the mission to the vision to the strategy to the execution. And that means in every facet of management. So you see this evidence, and we can talk about very specific examples. It's actually an understudy field. So I sort of, happened onto this. There have been a couple of commentators in the recent past, but Sir John Templeton, the great investor of the 20th century, once invited me about 15 years ago to look at this nexus and to stop doing some of the consulting work I was doing and focusing on that, and I did that, and, this is the result. Now, there is a moral advantage for doing business this way.
Mm-hmm.
And some other researchers at Stanford and others have argued that there's a kind of this is Adam Smith's argument, that there's a kind of moral sentiment that constrains economic life, okay, keeps you from doing some things, like don't lie, cheat, or steal, and also promotes other things, and that's what we're going to talk about here. And by doing those two things, constraining and promoting, that's kind of economic virtue and economic vice, if you will, it creates trust. And this is a very important word, because it's absolutely lacking in many circles today. Without trust, we don't have a market economy. Market economies depend on trust. Those are the sentiments that place the one who possesses them in a position to succeed.
Mm-hmm. I do like that. Let me just take a tangential question, though, because you said something that intrigued me. You said this stuff about virtue has not been talked about in business schools for a number of decades, if not centuries now. Why do you suppose that is? Why did we give up on that? It seems so critical. Earlier on in the podcast, you laid out how, we need political freedom, economic freedom, but we also need that spiritual capital that is so critical, but we don't teach it anymore. What happened?
Well, there are a couple of answers to that question. One is the long, slow slog of secularization. So we have given up, certainly in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, this notion of religiosity, of spiritual connectedness, and we think that we are just material beings, mm-hmm. and that secular forces take over, and that we crowd out, any of these other arguments about who we are and where we derive meaning and how we conceive ourselves and our enterprises. So that's one thing. The second thing is we've dumbed down our corporations with this notion of ethics that is now constrained within the concept of compliance. So it's not about what you need to do in order to be a good company or to form a good enterprise or to be a company of honesty and durability. It's what you have to do to stay out of jail.
Yeah,
that minimum level, mm-hmm. which is really not what ethics is first and foremost about, which is living a good and purposeful life.
And you're talking about compliance to the letter of the law.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's...
And it's just on that line, and that's... If business ethics is taught at business schools, and you heard me right, if, because about half of them don't teach it at all. They don't teach it at all. If it's taught, it's taught as some kind of compliance in the end, is, basically get out of jail free card. If you do this minimal amount of stuff, and you do that in your back offices, you can go on with your rapacious behavior and do whatever you damn well choose because you won't go to jail. And that's ethics. So we need to step back from that, and this is what my new book, The End of Ethics, is all about, and say, what have then been the consequences? Why do we have MF Global, LIBOR, Enron, WorldCom? I mean, I go down the list here. Why do we have those situations in our business communities today? And it used to be, and I used to argue this myself, well, it's just a few rotten apples. You know, there are a few bad individuals. You know, Madoff is Madoff. He's evil. And Bernie Ebbers is just an accounting fraud. There's too much of it now. It's systemic. So we have to ask these much deeper, more sustained questions about how do we get ourselves into this jam.
It comes back to that issue, I think, of political freedom, as you mentioned before, limited government. And one could just fully understand that the more laws and regulations you have, you know, human beings only have so much time to do things that compliance becomes the entire business of your day. Just let's comply with these so many laws that when we had a period in our history when there were fewer laws, you had to rely upon your spiritual capital to guide you. But now it's just, hey, what does this big, huge book of regulatory code say? Let's go to chapter 9, section 5.2.3, subsection 4, or something like that. You can imagine how that has a deteriorating effect upon our spiritual capital.
It does. And if you go back to the ancients, Plato and Aristotle, amongst others, certainly the church fathers, there's this notion that, I don't know, it's a sexist term, gentlemen don't need legislation. They govern themselves. Now, there's a notion. We govern ourselves. So this notion of self-governance, and then, you know, if you think of proximity circles, in a corporate culture, how does a company, small, medium, large, I study mostly large companies, how does it govern itself? How does it then, within its industry cluster, govern that industry? So before we even step into a more public sphere, we've taken many of these things off the table because we're acting rightly.
Mm-hmm. And this is where you bring in the issue of virtues. And we'll come back to that because, again, I like this in your book of Doing Virtuous Business, how you talk about two different types of virtues, hard virtues and soft virtues. And if you tell us the difference between hard and soft virtues, and then we'll get into some of the specific hard virtues.
Sure. Well, we're dealing with virtue ethics here, so it's a bit strange in Alistair McIntyre's world after virtue. I'm trying to resurrect some antique language here, which obviously has connections both to the classical world. You heard me mention Plato and Aristotle and others. It has to do with the theological world of Augustine, Calvin, and others, and obviously of a theological and religious sort, because religion is largely about virtuous behavior. I mean, that's what sanctification is, leading that kind of good life, following the word. So we typically then have this list of a discussion of what are the virtues, how they arrived at, how do you form these kinds of character traits. And I make the division between hard virtues and those that we could sometimes argue have a more masculine tone. I don't mean to divide this into secular gender categories, but leadership, courage, patience, perseverance, and discipline. In other words, virtues that are, you know, very blunt, that help you get the job done. Yeah, most companies do realize that you have to have some of these things, even though there's some discussion about how you get them or where they come from. And what I call the soft virtues. So I have 14 virtues altogether. I'd really love to have these discussions, not just in the academy, but in the real business world, about what are the virtues? How are they formed? How do you decide between them? How do you prioritize them? How do you maximize them? Which comes before the other? How they reinforce each other? What is prudence in the context of choosing these virtues? But the soft virtues are those that are more readily identified with being, feminine. So mm-hmm. Those are the virtues of justice, compassion, forgiveness, gratitude, and foremost, this is a major religious virtue that's totally gone in our culture, humility.
Humility is,
so yeah. We're apt to look at these as what I call stay-at-home virtues. If they're virtues at all, you know, you keep them in the back room, you do them yourself, you don't bother others with them. Mm-hmm. Certainly not good for a company. So what the critics of capitalism, capitalist companies, say that these softer virtues have no place. You never see them in the business under free enterprise capitalism, the dog-eat-dog world that you described earlier, you know, as Gordon Gekko's kind of greedy capitalism. They are wrong. These virtues have a place, and these virtues do exist. And the very interesting thing about my book, when I went out to research, is I have found many examples where you find both these hard and soft virtues. No one company has all the virtues.
Mm-hmm.
Even you, Tony, are not a virtuous person.
Oh, I know. My pastor tells me that all the time.
But you do better at some than others.
Right.
You're working at this as a path, as a journey, and so too do companies. So the interesting thing then is to look in a very hard way at how these companies maximize these different virtues. What can we learn from them?
Well, let's cover
fascinating work.
Yeah, let's cover some of these. Let's start off with these hard virtues of, well, leadership and courage seem fairly obvious hard virtues. We can think of the old warrior class of the day, you know, we must lead and I'll lead by example and march forward. One of the more interesting ones that you include in the hard virtues is patience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I first read that, I guess patience, that sounds like a soft virtue.
Yeah.
Why is patience a hard virtue? And could you give us an example of how this plays out in the real world? I think you talk about the CEO of PriceSmart as an exemplar of this.
Yeah, well, one of the things we do in our book is to try to highlight, you know, not just the kind of theological or philosophical orientation of these virtues to make it an academic discussion, but to try to bring it home with, you know, real case examples. In fact, I mean, this is another chance to plug something. I just finished writing 26 new case studies at Yale School of Management on 26 companies that exhibit these virtues. And the book is going to be published next year in an academic text format called Practical Wisdom for Management.
Mm-hmm.
So there'll be, you know, everybody argues, and at least in the teaching world, undergraduate and MBAs, that, well, we would like to teach this stuff. We just don't have any cases. You know, all the cases are written by Harvard guys who are, you know, nefarious, and they write about all this other stuff. Well, now you got 26 new cases done in a Yale template.
Well, so give us an example of patience and the case study
of... Well, patience, again, comes from this Latin word to suffer, you know, to bear pains, trials calmly, without complaint. I find patience, I think you do too, I talked to you offline about this, one of the most difficult. My wife says I don't practice it very well. I think she's right.
Yeah.
So this is a disposition that is necessary, it's needful for anyone who wishes to triumph over adversity, to persist, you know, in time. And this kind of patience then focuses our efforts on what we can change while accepting what we cannot change. It's the virtue, frankly, in a religious sense, of the martyr and also of the dogged commander who never loses sight of the final goal. So patience is enjoyed on us, first of all, I think, in the religious context, by faith. Jews, Christians alike, treasure this wonderful book in the Old Testament called Job.
Yep.
Which shows that patience is the sublime refuge that faith alone cannot guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
So patience rests on the other virtues. Even in the Quran, you see this statement, to seek help with patience and prayer. This is indeed hard, except for the humble in spirit. So it's also tied to humility. But, you know, some companies, listed a few of them in the book with some detail, are really patient, are very long-suffering. They try and try and try again, and if they're lucky and things line up, they succeed. They're durable. I mean, this notion of built to last, which Jim Collins has written about, these kinds of companies. I once wrote an article on the companies in the UK on High Street. If you look at these companies in any town in Britain, you've got banks, chocolate stores, bookstores, you know, the chemistry store, they call that the pharmacy,
mm-hmm.
Boots. All these companies, when you go back and trace their roots, they're 175, 250 years old. They all come from a nonconformist, that means non-Anglican, or Quaker background. And they all suffered through. This was the economy that allowed them to do what they were going to do, and they all suffered through. They were patient and persevering in that presence. And many of them have succeeded to this very day.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Tell us a little bit about this Robert Price of PriceSmart. That's the one exemplar that you give explicitly in the book. Near the end, you give a list of different companies that exhibit each of these different virtues. And tell us a little bit about PriceSmart. I only vaguely know that company.
Mm-hmm. Well, Robert Price, he founded PriceSmart. You know, I think on the West Coast, you know it. It's not known all over the U.S.
Yeah.
It sells high quality merchandise at very low prices.
That's probably why I don't know.
Members of their stores, and it actually has a great reputation, unlike some of its competitors, of paying very fair wages and having very strong benefits for employees. So this is he was kind of a retailing innovator. His name was Saul Price. He's a Jewish gentleman. Started the store, I think, as early as 1954. And then it got reinvented and developed. And I think it was in 1976 it became known as the Price Club. It's like $70 billion worth of stores now all over the U.S. and 12 other countries, expanding now in warehouses in China. So
I do remember Price Club. Yes, yeah. I do remember that name. Okay. They just changed the name on me. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this notion of, and I talked to him about his company, this notion of PriceSmart grew out of his definition of patience coming from a Torah tradition. And for him, a very close reading of God's dialogue with Job. And that's how they were able to suffer through and do what they had done in that very competitive piece of the economy.
Mm-hmm. Let me go ahead and turn now to some of the soft virtues that you talk about. Because, again, when you get to the hard virtues, leadership, courage, perseverance, discipline, everybody goes, yeah, you need those for your business to succeed. You know, patience, it's a little bit different. Yeah, the whole issue of suffering or taking time, everything's not going to come to you immediately, is I can see that as being a hard virtue. But some of these softer virtues, I mean, most people today would look at these things and they say, this is foreign to the corporate world. This issue of justice, of forgiveness, of compassion, of humility or of gratitude. Actually, you mentioned humility as one of the key soft virtues. Tell us why humility is such an important virtue in the corporate world.
Well, it is so critical, and it's such a hard lesson to learn, particularly for CEOs in the control and command kind of modality. Some of them are gone these days. You know, we've flattened our organizations, gotten rid of the old Jack Welch style of behavior. But this notion of humility, which comes from the Latin, again, of low status of, in the biblical tradition, the humility being the first virtue in the spiritual life, you know, Jesus literally washing the feet of his disciples. Not the picture of a business person, right?
Right, right.
So every virtue, I would argue, that is not tempered by humility, in the end, turns to conceit and to narcissism. So, I mean, here I'm using religious language. When God grants us a talent, literally, we need to ask him as well for the humility to properly enjoy it, to make it useful to others. And then the role of humility in business is really very difficult to describe. You see very few companies that practice it well. It's attested to by some business leaders, but not nearly enough. But it has this deep spiritual source. Humility is tied to the French source of that word, to what is referred to as the mutual relation between a rider and a horse, close to the concept that we see in dressage or mastery through cooperation. So I talked to Bill Pollard, who was CEO for over a decade of a company called Service Master. It's gone through a few iterations now. It's been taken into a private equity firm. It's going to be coming public again soon. It's a multi-billion-dollar company. They own a couple of businesses you may have heard of, like Terminex and Amermaids and food services, et cetera. But this notion of service is so critical to the notion of humility, of serving the customer not just putting your profits in front of everything else and cheating and taking every short turn and cutting every corner you can.
Yeah, I guess that goes
with... It has a lot of implications for the way you do business.
I guess it goes with that old adage of the customer knows best. And one can see that humility oftentimes exhibits itself in the small businessmen. That they're very grateful for you coming to do your dry cleaning there, and they're very responsive to you. But as the company gets bigger and bigger and bigger, you control more. And I think back in terms of F.A. Hayek, one of my favorite economists, who says that at a certain point, we start to think that if we know a little bit, therefore we know a lot. And we lose that humility of how much we don't know and how much we need to rely upon others. I love the example that you use of the rider and the horse, is that, you know, I think I command the horse, but actually the horse has a lot to do with it. And we have to be humble in terms of doing that. And so I could kind of see how...
You're absolutely true about this notion in the mom and pop business. So we all know that, right? The guy down the street, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. What I'm trying to discover, though, is... example where people have been able to use and perfect these virtues in much larger entities. And it is more difficult, and certainly in global entities is stretched beyond compare. And that's why it's so interesting to find them, and to find particularly these soft virtues, people that are exceedingly honest, you know, who really use honesty as an integral part of practice of how they do business. I talk about the Four Seasons hotel chain, which Isidore Sharp, a wonderful Jewish immigrant in Toronto, founded, based on this notion of honesty. He calls it loving kindness, which is a Jewish term from the Torah, again. Or, you know, gratitude. I mean, my kids aren't even grateful to me, let alone, you know, people I've worked with. So this notion of acknowledging gifts is very powerful, certainly in the business setting, where it is insufficiently appreciated. The person who gives thanks for what he receives, who knows best to value it and how to attain it. It's one of the most remarkable achievements, I think, of European socialism has been to create a society from which gratitude has all but disappeared. I'm afraid of that happening in America, Tony.
Yeah, and you mentioned this in terms of secularization and what might be happening, that this road that we're traveling on has been transforming itself over time. And many people could attribute it to a lot of different causes, you know, modern technology isolates us, et cetera, et cetera. But your whole work actually deals with this spiritual capital, that secularization chips away with that, and we lose some of these soft virtues. And it seems as if the soft virtues are the ones that go first before the harder virtues do.
I think you're right. And gratitude is an interesting one to look at. I wrote a whole book on the virtue of generosity called Being Generous. But, you know, think about the benefits that the state promises, the government promises. And nobody really feels grateful for them. And nobody feels the impulse to return a gift as a result of getting them. So virtually nobody who benefits from college, say in Europe, gives back to his alma mater. I'm a graduate of a Scottish university. They don't even know who went to the university. All the institutions, from schools to hospitals, everything in between, they look to the state for more or less all of their support. And one of the strengths, I think, of our American capitalist, more capitalist economy is that it reminds people at every turn of the great gifts they receive from others and from the free exercise of human choice. And therefore, you know, a kind of capitalist economy, a more capitalist one, such as we enjoy, is one where people are constantly giving back. I mean, Americans are the most generous. I've done quantitative analysis on that. 12 times more generous than the people in France. They give money to their schools, to the universities. At the end of the year, I mean, the giving is unbelievable to the local communities, to our churches, synagogues, mosques, the hospitals. I mean, they just give back because they feel fortunate because they've been able to earn themselves. And they want, frankly, to help others, often in need.
Many, many people might attribute that to the tax code and the incentives that are structured there, and I think part of that is true. But I think your discussion of spiritual capital and what has made America an exemplar in the world in terms of spiritual capital has been that gratitude. It's not just the tax code. It's not just an incentive. There is something embedded deep in our Judeo-Christian ethos that says, yeah, be thankful for what you have. And as you mentioned, that might be chipping away a little bit. One of the things I do want to ask about, and I know you're a very strong advocate of personal liberty, of personal autonomy, as we talked about before, and that's become somewhat popular in some circles. I see a number of young students are moving toward libertarianism. They get very excited about this, and one of the people that they turn to is Ayn Rand. I hear this around campus all the time, people walking around with The Fountainhead and her other books as well. And championing this role of the rugged individual. Now, a lot of what Ayn Rand says deals with what you would call some of the harder virtues. But on the other hand, she's missing, I think, some of the soft virtues. What's your take on Rand?
Well, I am not a Randian. That's most definitely the case. I do find in some circles undue attention to Rand, who is undeserving, but there are a lot of opponents of capitalism and certain defenders as well who grew out of this, I call it Nietzschean tradition, which she is part of, that see morality as a kind of a slave, and so they have no room for compassion. But this notion of compassion, I would argue, is the core morality of Christianity, actually of Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Judaism as well. And that's rejected by Ayn Rand. In her influential defense of capitalism as the expression of human freedom and power, you know, it has a very telling title. You know the title. It's The Virtue of Selfishness. I didn't read that in either testament. Now, for Rand and her followers, the essence of this free economy is individualism, rugged individualism, as you said, is self-assertion. I just don't see this definition that she provides as either present or possible. So, this notion that capitalism is Darwinian, that there's a constant struggle for scarce resources, and only the fittest survive. I mean, you mentioned the title of one of her books and some of her characters, and we have to have this conflict over resources.
Mm-hmm.
It's just false. The economy is built on cooperation, on the attempt to bring those resources into being. And that's what capitalism is all about. It's about the mutual creation of wealth rather than the antagonistic pillaging of it. And we recognize then the place of these virtues and compassion in business. It's compassion and cooperation that enables us to pursue our goals without conflict, by arousing the sympathy and the goodwill of others. Read Adam Smith. It makes us flexible in the face of opposition, gives us insight into the feelings and desires of those with whom we have to deal. The kind of self-assertion, the kind of individualism that is extolled by Rand, is really a brittleness of character, an unyielding self-centeredness that I think is soon fractured by the conflicts it engenders. When it, in fact, appears, it's not even an accurate description.
Yeah, and that's why I thoroughly enjoy your discussion of the softer virtues, specifically humility, because once you start getting into this very assertive individualism, you think you know it all. You're not humble. You lose your desire to cooperate. And you said it extremely well, that capitalism is about mutual cooperation. Somebody saying, hey, I have a specific talent. I can do certain things with this, but I need some help. And so I'm going to humble myself before everybody else and say, hey, can you help me? Can you trade with me? Can you engage in other entrepreneurial activities? Because we're all in this together. Let me go ahead and finish off our podcast with a little bit of prognostication on your part. You mentioned that you have a book that is and coming out in March, where you propose some remedies for some of these things that they're talking about. You call this the end of ethics, and it's about the worst business practices. And so that really sums up our what many people are thinking, what's been happening over the past couple decades with the Enron and stuff. But that book also, you intend to address some remedies for this. And so my final question to you is, are you fairly optimistic that our environment that we're in right now, which may engender a little bit of pessimism could be turned around? Do you have some optimism for the future?
Well, I am by definition always an optimist. So when I see a glass that's half empty, I call it half full. But I think we have to also realistically assess our times. Where are we in the state of human progress? Where is the economy? We just talked about charitable institutions. We could talk about the presence or lack of some virtues. And we need to do that realistically and describe it full force. And we try to do that in this book. We actually argue that we have come to a state in capitalism, which I call managerial or crony capitalism, where people are cheating their way ahead and they're cutting all the corners. And they're involved in what I call economic vice too often and not the economic virtues we've been describing here this morning. And we need to find a way, both by reforming their characters and by redoing their corporate cultures and hopefully our institutions, and some of that means regulatory structures, to put the system back in a better situation, to have a kind of moral or what I call virtuous capitalism. So I'm optimistic about the possibilities for that, but I also see it as a new and uncharted path. It's work.
And what about, we talked about secularization and how that has been eroding some of these virtues. What is your view of America's spiritual capital? Are we on the verge of another great awakening, or are we sliding toward a moral and religious abyss that we might not want to go towards?
Well, you have fairly strong advocates on both sides of that question.
Yeah.
Someone won a Nobel Prize once for arguing that we're in the next spiritual reawakening. And there's lots of good sociological evidence of that,
mm-hmm.
not only in America, but around the world. A recent Pew survey just came out and showed that, of the more than 7 billion people in the world, 6.5 billion are practicing some religion or another. In other words, what we were taught in graduate school about the withering of religion, whether it was by our neo-Marxist friends or by the positivists who thought that secularization was the path of the future, is actually inaccurate. They got it wrong.
Yeah.
Religion is still a major force in the world. It's present in America. We still have a very high belief in God. We have a lot of religious institutions. We have a higher percentage of church attendance. So spirituality, religious life is still, I would argue, very vibrant and very present in America, and that means in all of its subcultures as well. I would say in the mainline churches, it's unfortunately petering out and dying, but in other places it's resurfacing, and you see the same phenomenon in other religions around the world. So secularization theory has categorically and empirically been proved false.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Am I overly optimistic about these new communities, these new spiritual endeavors, the seeker movement, the rise of Pentecostalism or charismatics, non-denominational church? I think it's a reality and an interesting one that we're still charting. I think it has huge impacts on the way we live our lives and even for the way we do business.
And I think that's a good place to leave off. We'll have to come back and visit again to see how this is all playing out, and we'd be delighted.
Thank you for this great podcast. I'm almost a religious devotee to it. It's well done.
Well, very good. Thank you very much. And so, Ted, I just want to thank you for being on the show today.
Good, Tony. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.